Hi, welcome to another edition of The Calling. This is the Reverend Marek Zabriskie, Rector of Christ Church Greenwich. And riding shotgun with me is Andrew Boyer, colleague, friend, member of the church, tennis partner, and the inspiration for getting this podcast started.
Good to be back, Marek.
Great to have you here. We focus on interesting people who have really found their calling in life and help them share that with us so that all of us might learn a little bit about the ways in which we are called to serve and give of ourselves and allow our God-given gifts and talents to be put to a greater and higher use. And today, we're privileged to have Lynn Twist, the author of an incredible book called The Soul of Money, Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Life. And she has a new book out entitled The Keys to Living a Committed Life, Simple and Powerful Ways You Can Find Fulfillment in a Calling Larger than Yourself. Today, we're going to explore money, its pull and its grasp on us, and how we can move from kind of the tight closed fist to the open hand and allow our resources to be a blessing for us and others. It's such an important part of the life journey, and we couldn't have a better person than Lynn Twist, who's authored this great book, who has traveled the world over the past 40 years and met with some of the poorest people on the planet and some of the wealthiest families on the planet. She's worked with Mother Teresa in Calcutta, refugee camps in Ethiopia, and been focused on the threatened rainforests of the Amazon and guiding philanthropy from some individuals in countless countries to channel their resources to make a better world for all. Lynn, we're thrilled to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I wonder if I might begin with a question that has to do with in the forward to your book, Jack Canfield, the author of Chicken Soup for the Soul, writes, before he met you, he defined success as being able to produce whatever results you wanted in the world. After meeting you, he changed his definition of success to fulfilling your soul's purpose. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about that? We don't hear that many people talk about soul. What is it? And how do we, you know, fulfill our soul's purpose?
Well, I think this word success, you know, when you talk to parents and ask, how's your son or daughter? And they say, oh, he's very successful. You really immediately think, oh, he's making a lot of money, because that's the way we define success now. It's just narrowed down to money. And that's kind of happened to life. Everything's narrowed down to how much money you make or whether you are in the chips or not in the chips, or whether your wealth is going up or it's going down. So we've narrowed our lives so tragically to our relationship with the economics of life rather than the fullness, the richness of what life really means. And so when I use this term, the soul of money, I'm not saying that money has soul, but to remind us that we do. And to pair the longings and yearnings of our soul with our financial resources, whether they're modest or excessive, is the key in many ways to a life of true prosperity. Because prosperity isn't this thing called money. Prosperity is when you're prospering in your relationship with yourself and in the world. And that comes from service. That comes from contribution. That comes from being engaged with the beauty, the power of making a difference with your life. And so the Soul of Money book is really, and the Soul of Money work is really about true, what I call true prosperity, which is being fully alive, fully in touch with who you are and the gifts you have to give. That's what makes a prosperous life. And we've gotten it confused with accumulating resources, financial resources primarily, but also boats and cars and trains and and more square feet in our homes. And you know, I value all that too. That's not bad or good. It's just that we've gotten caught in one dimension so deeply that we've forgotten about the wider experience of what it means to be human.
Now, I spent 23 years serving a church in the outskirts of Philadelphia. And I came to think that if you can raise money in Philadelphia, you can raise it anywhere. Because there's a pervasive mentality of scarcity. Mm. Philadelphia was settled by Quakers under William Penn, And their adage was, if it isn't broke, don't fix it. I don't have money. You want to talk to the person over there. That's the person who you want to go see. And then when you see them, they say, well, I'm the poorest person here. You want to see that person. Mm. There was a culture of scarcity. A friend of mine who ran the biggest church in the diocese said, he came from Texas. He said, "And you know, here, if you give someone a slice of pie, everyone else thinks that means I get a smaller slice." Mm-hmm. He said, "In Texas, we just bake a bigger pie." So how do you know, you talk in your book about that three myths of scarcity: not enough, more is better, and that's just the way it is. Could you kind of unpack that for us and why scarcity is so crippling to us as individuals and our culture?
Well, I call it the lie of scarcity, and that's a strong statement. The word lie is a strong word. But I name it that because I'm really talking about an unconscious, unexamined mindset. Not what we think, but from where we think in the consumer culture we've been born and raised in. And I'm not talking about people who don't have what they really need. Those people really do need more water, more opportunity, more jobs, more food. I'm talking about those of us who are living primarily in affluent parts of the world and have this craving for more of everything. And where does that come from? I say it comes from the culture which promotes a unconscious, unexamined mindset that there's not enough to go around, and somewhere, somebody's going to be left out, and you got to make sure it's not you and yours. And then you need to define who you and yours are, which makes us kind of tribal, because these are my people, and we want to make sure that we're okay, and then we'll help those other people someday, but we need a whole lot more than we need before we can do that. That's kind of the unconscious, unexamined, unspoken mindset of the culture we live in. And Buddha said the source of all suffering is a lie. And I say the lie of scarcity is the source of tremendous suffering in our relationship with money. Most people have wounds and hurts in their relationship with money. They went bankrupt, or they had a very, very nasty divorce, or they had a harsh father that yelled at them about money, or they were constrained in some way by a boss. So most people have baggage, wounds, and hurts around money that are pretty, you know, much a source of suffering for them in life. And I say that suffering really comes from these lies our culture says about money, that if you just have more of it, everything's going to be okay. And I work with some ultra high net worth families, some of our global billionaire families. And, you know, obviously it's wonderful to have financial resources. It's wonderful to have some measure of wealth. But when it gets into the extremes, sometimes life gets horribly complicated. You can't figure out who's your friend. Everybody's after you. You don't know what's real. You have so much power in our culture, you lose track of your own humanity, your own humility. And some of these families are riddled with a kind of suffering that's deeper than anything I've ever seen in poverty, which is where I've worked for most of my life. So there's a lot of things to be said about how money and huge amounts of it sometimes can distort one's sense of self, so you can't really remember kind of really who you are, because you think you are your net worth. You think you are your trust fund. You think you are your bonus. And then you forget, you know, that's just an accoutrement. Who you are is a loving human being.
What about sort of the, I'm going to call it the King Lear effect, right? Like once you are, you know, you're on top of the world, you have lots of money, you have lots of power, then you decide, okay, it's time to give it away, or it's time to step back. And then society starts to deem you kind of irrelevant. So what about that? Like, I think if you're talking about kind of moving from a, you know, a create more, you know, money or value to a, create more service, what about dealing with society and how it treats you?
Well, that's a problem. Not something that I can solve, but one needs to, I think people listening and who are in that kind of space, need to look and see what's really important to them. Is it what people think, or is being true to yourself? You know, integrity really is what makes a life of character and fulfillment, and not what everybody thinks of you. And there's a opportunity to inspire people rather than be someone who everybody wants to be after all the time. And that's a different role. And I, you know, when you think about who really moves the dial, who really changes the world, you think about people like Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi. It's not the global billionaires. Now, they have a huge impact. Some of that's positive, yes, but a lot of it is not so positive. When you look at the accumulation of wealth at the top now, it is so almost like it's almost obscene to me, and you know, it's harsh. It's a harsh word to use, but no one needs billions and billions and approaching trillions of dollars in their control. That is so kind of sets everything in this kind of weird off-balanceness where you can buy a town. You know, you can do things that just aren't right. It's not right for people to have that kind of overwhelming dominance. That's not the way this is meant to be. And we all know that, including the people that have those kind of resources. But society almost forces you to want that. And then, you know, I know people that have that kind of money, and I can't call them the happiest people I've ever met. It isn't really all that wonderful. No, they can't trust anybody around them. They're protected. They have to go everywhere in darkened windows. They have to find private planes. That sounds fun for a while, but then it gets tedious. You're not rubbing against the sandpaper of life. You're not developing yourself, really. You're dominating everything around you, and you can't see anymore. So, you know, I don't want to be too hard on these people because I know some of them. But, you know, it's hard work, and it's not exactly what everybody thinks it's cracked up to be.
You know, Lynn, I have a beer-drinking gourd that was given to me in a little village in Kenya, in the remote kind of jungle area where I was about over 35 years ago when I was in seminary working for a bishop one summer. And these people had nothing. They had really almost, you know, barely any objects in any of their mud huts that they could share. But this precious hand-painted gourd is something they gave me just for coming to visit the village. And I found the people there happier by far than most Americans, and they had almost nothing. So I was struck when I read your book and read about your encounter with a small group of women at Microsoft who were, the average age was 36, average net worth was $10 million, and they were really, you know, having those golden handcuffs. They were shackled to their work, working extraordinarily long hours, having other people really raise their children. And a number of them, you mentioned, did not give any money to charity at all, and they barely had time with their family. And they might have said, you know, my family's the most important thing in my life, but if you looked at how their time was spent, there is no correlation. How do you help people like that get some insight in themselves before they've lost the opportunity to actually be with their family and to help them really align their values and their life in such a way that they can experience soul and be their, you know, reach their best potential as a human?
Well, I remember that talk I gave at that time, and I had a lot of compassion for these women because we all get caught up. I mean, it wasn't just them. I really saw myself also in that setting. You know, I'm out there ending world hunger and saving the environment and stuff, and sometimes I don't have enough time to spend with my family, so I couldn't really point the finger at them so much. But I really recognize also, though, that what people want for their life and what the reality of their life is sometimes is not a match. You know, we want healthy children. We want time to develop ourselves. We want time in nature. We want all these things. But then the culture we have swoops in and just kind of hijacks us. And so we're all sort of at the effect of that. And what in that setting, what was so touching for me is when we had the opportunity, and I was so grateful for that opportunity to spend time with them, you know, when you really get right down to it, everybody's working as hard as they can to live a life of meaning and fulfillment. But the society, the culture we live in, demands something else from us. It's not that supportive, the culture we live in. It's all about consuming stuff. In fact, now that we have social media, when I gave that talk at Microsoft, it was before social media. And now, you know, your kids are on their devices all day long for school because they have to do it in school. Then they come home, then they're on their devices all night long. And then they're texting their friends, they're playing games online. You know, they're not outside, a lot of them. They have a different kinds of sports now. They even have, gaming sports online. So we're living at a time where we really have to rethink, how can we live in this world with all this technology and all of these demands on us in a way that we truly fulfill who we are as human beings? So I had a lot of compassion for those women at Microsoft. And I think the talk that we did there, Rianne Eisler was there too, the woman who wrote The Chalice and the Blade. We made a difference. And after that that encounter, many of them actually, I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but they left. They left Microsoft. And, many of them wrote to both Rianne and me and said, you know, I've got as much money as I'm ever going to need, and I'm going to do something different. I'm going to go teach high school. I'm going to go work on a Indian reservation and tell young people how to code so they can make more money. I'm going to go to Africa and build a well. I was so pleased to hear that some of them were able to free themselves, not from Microsoft. I don't mean to make that company wrong. My God, they've created miracles for me and everybody. But from the grip of this monster called the modern world that kind of forces us to think that making money is the purpose of life. And of course it's not. We all know that. But we forget. We live in an economic system that promotes above all making money. And, you know, we get hijacked by that. All of us do.
I've served four parishes now. And in one parish, a parishioner said that he had given over $1 million in a certain political cycle to one party to kind of further what they were doing. I asked him for a very modest gift towards a capital endeavor we were doing. And he looked at me across the table at lunch and he said, "What am I going to get out of this?" And I just felt so sorry for him. You know, I thought, here is someone who really has a closed fist. He gave to the political party because it benefited his own business. So he really saw something coming back. You've devoted a lot of your life to fundraising, and there's a real spirituality behind that, isn't there? Could you tell us a little bit about how that's a ministry for you and a spiritual endeavor?
Yeah, let me see how to talk about that. I do feel that it's a spiritual calling for me to move money towards the highest good wherever I can, in whatever way I can. And to empower and inspire people to do the same. You know, I've learned most of my lessons, and I think this may be true for you, Reverend Merrick, that from people that I used to call poor. And I never use that term now with a human being because I know those people. I've met with them. I've worked with them in Bangladesh, in Ethiopia after the famine in 1984 and 1985. I've spent time with people after the Mozambique War. I know there's nothing poor about them. What's poor is their circumstances, not them. In fact, who they are people with such inner strength, such spiritual depth, such creativity. They exhibit more courage to live through a day than you and I are going to need in our lifetime. And the circumstances of resource-poor people actually foster a kind of inner strength in who they are, a generosity, a humility, a gratefulness for the fact that they're alive. And so I learned so much from people that I used to call poor, so I never call people poor any longer. I call them people living in resource-poor circumstances because that's what's poor, their circumstances, but not them. In fact, they're awesome. And then I've stopped calling people rich also because if you call people rich, you're defining them by their circumstances, and that's not who they are. And they start to think they are those circumstances. That start to be their identity. And then it's very hard to let go of money. If you think the money is your identity, if you think it's who you are, then giving it away has to be transactional, like your friend that you talked about. What do I get out of this? Because, you know, this is my identity. If I don't get something, I'm not playing. That's that transactional way of being is when someone's gotten caught in thinking that who they are is their financial resources rather than who they are as a human being. And they have financial resources that ebb and flow and come and go and can be used in ways that make a difference. So distinguishing a human being from their financial resources and not labeling them rich, poor, I would say even progressive, liberal, all conservative, all of those labels make us crazy and we can't listen to each other anymore. We actually listen to people with a lens that defines who they are before they even speak. And so finding our own humanity, to me, is the key. Relating to each other as what does it mean to be human is the key to what I call spiritual fundraising. And then what do you really care about? What breaks your heart? What makes your heart sing? Those two things are usually related. What breaks your heart and what makes your heart sing? If you put those two things together, you find a place where you can really make a difference with your money, with your life, with your heart, with your soul. So I'd say spiritual fundraising, or the fundraising that I love to do, is being with people in a way that they discover who they are and why they're here and what difference they can make with their life, with their time, with their energy, and with their money. And that's a service to people. Even if they say, no, thank you, I'm not interested in ending world hunger, but talking to you makes me realize I do want to make a contribution to the homeless shelter down the street from my home. I've never thought about it until this conversation, and I consider that a win. If they say no to me for what I'm asking for, and I've touched their heart and opened their mind up a little bit to giving, then it's a successful fundraising ask. And if you do it from integrity and touching into who people are, every ask makes a difference. Every ask is a win. Every ask opens the floodgates to have money move towards the highest good. So that's why I love fundraising. That's why I love asking for money. And that's why I love being with people, because it's always intimate. When you get started talking about money, people, you know, they tense up. But if you break them open so that they really think about who am I, what matters to me, and whether or not the thing I'm talking about matters to them or not, if I can listen deeply to who they are, then something miraculous happens. And sometimes they actually loosen up the grip on that money and let it go into something they care about.
Lynn, one of the things that I've picked up even from the short time I've known you is that you think really big. And you're thinking about Ethiopia, you're thinking about the Amazon, you're thinking about India. And one of the challenges I think that most people, or that I have in particular with giving, is that, and it's related to sort of what Merrick was talking about with that parishioner, but you want to feel like you can see the impact in some way of your giving. And when you're talking about things that are half a world away, there's really no way of measuring that impact in any meaningful way. So how do you measure what is the importance of impact and being able to see impact in giving, and how do you think about it?
Well, I'm going to give a kind of a strange answer. I don't have a lot of attention on that, which is interesting. I think the act of giving you have to make sure the tail is not wagging the dog. I actually encourage people to give what I call core unrestricted support to the mission of an organization rather than a project. If they're willing, it's okay to fund a project. I'm all for that too, excuse me. So, but when you think about if you're funding the heart and the lungs of an organization, you're paying for every project, you're paying for every initiative, and you're giving that project and the people running it the trust and love, take this money and make it happen. Make your mission happen. I'm on for the mission. So I encourage core support. I never call it overhead. But, you know, when you pay for for example, for making sure that Merrick is well taken care of in this beautiful church, when you are willing to give core support for whatever needs to be fixed in the sanctuary, you're giving him and the people here the freedom to really have the mission flourish here. And it's wonderful to pay for the new boiler, which is one of the stories he told when we were just talking earlier. So all of it's good. What I think is really what selfless giving is really knowing that if your heart is in it, and somebody might even make some mistakes with the money you give them, well, God bless them for that. You know, if you just let it go, it's not transactional. You're not trying to force something. You're just being of service. You're trusting. You're in partnership. I have this thing I say that the 20th century was very much about, at least in the what we call nonprofit, not for profit, non-governmental sector. And by the way, I don't like those terms. I don't like defining us by what we're not. I call us social profits. And social profit can be spelled two ways. We're generating a social profit for the world or for the community or for the town or for the country. But it also can be spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T. We're standing for a future that we want to bring into existence by being a social profit, generating that kind of future for life. But I also feel that when we... When we're really telling the truth about what we're up to and we touch into the core of who people are, they just want to be helpful and they want to make sure that their money is helpful and makes a difference. And they don't want to cling to it and see exactly where it went, maybe. And some people do, and that's okay too. But sometimes it's just generosity, pure generosity and trust. And we're in a time now in history where our trust has been broken, particularly in the United States, but it's a global, we're in a crisis of trust. And I have a strange relationship with this. Maybe it's a little bit odd, but I don't think trust is something you earn. I think you give people trust, and then they become trustworthy because they're trusted, rather than they have to earn your trust. People become trustworthy, children in particular, become trustworthy by being trusted rather than tested. At least that's true of my kids. So I think impact's really important, and there's a whole thing now about impact, and it's very important, and measurement and evaluation, and I'm all for that too. But I also want to make sure that people feel fine just giving money, because they love the person who's running the church, or they love the woman who's started the project and they want to help her get it going and she can use it any way she wants. I love that too. I think we just want to unlock the river of altruism and generosity that flows in every single heart that's been covered over by a culture that tells us we always need more for ourselves. And that's why I think fundraising is really holy work.
So let's drill down on that for a moment. You're a great storyteller, by the way, and you talk about a woman named Gertrude who taught you some important lessons, and also a CEO who you gave back a check for $50,000. Could you unpack the learnings from those two experiences? Because they were really profound.
And this is when I was a young fundraiser. I was scared to death of people with money. And I was summoned, the Hunger Project, my organization, was called to go to a Midwestern city to meet with the CEO of the largest food company in the world at that time. I'm not going to say the year or the company. And they had a huge public relations disaster. They were caught in a big scandal, and their stock was plummeting. And that same company called the Hunger Project office and said, send someone to meet with our CEO. We want to make a contribution to your work. So I went to this city. It was a breakfast. It was billed a breakfast meeting at 7:30 in the morning on a Tuesday. I went to the tallest building in that city, to the top floor, which was the CEO's private office. I walked in to the what was called the breakfast meeting at 7:30, and he was sitting behind the biggest desk I've ever seen in my entire life. It was like a dining room table. And behind him were floor-to-ceiling windows, and behind him the sun was rising. And he headed back to the windows, and all the light was on me, and I could not see this guy. You know how when people are backlit, you just can't see them. I never saw his eyes. I could not see him. And he sat there, and I sat across the desk from him, and I was given 15 minutes to talk about ending world hunger. And I remember looking at my watch, and he was, you know, he reached out of his shadowy, you know, backlit self and shook my hand at the beginning, and then he sort of sat there like I was supposed to start talking. It was a very cold encounter. And so I started talking about ending world hunger, and I looked at my watch, and when I'd been talking for 7 minutes, I realized I needed to stop and see if he had anything to say, because we only had 15 minutes. And he didn't say almost anything. I really can't remember if he said anything, but it was, he was so cold. And he opened the desk drawer on his side of the desk, and then he took out a long, yellow, already made out computer check made out to the Hunger Project for $50,000. And then I remember he took his fingers and he pushed it from his side of the desk across the table to my side of the desk, and I picked it up. And I remember when it came across the desk to me, it was like the guilt and shame and wrongdoing of the company was going from his side of the desk over to me. And I picked up the check, and I said, I had the presence of mind to say, thank you so much. And he stood up and reached out with his hand and shook it as if I'm, now you're supposed to leave. There was no human encounter. So I took the check and put it in my briefcase and got in the elevator and started going down, 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 down. It was the tallest building in the city. I got to the ground floor and I was sick to my stomach. I felt nauseous. And I hailed a cab and went to the airport, and I got in a Midwestern storm system, and my plane was going from that city to New York to do a fundraiser in a Harlem church that night. And I had plenty of time. But I, you know, we had to land in Kansas City, and then we landed in St. Louis, and we waited for the storm. Eventually, we get to New York. It's raining like crazy in New York. I'm very late to this church basement fundraiser in Harlem. I think it was an hour and a half or maybe 2 hours late. And we didn't have cell phones then. This is a long time ago. So I just went thinking, God, is anybody still there? I couldn't call them or, you know, tell them I was going to be late because I was on a plane the whole time. I get there, and in the church basement, there's 75 people sitting there, every chair filled, waiting for their speaker. You know, these fluorescent lights, bright, but rain outside, rain dripping inside too, because there were buckets everywhere from leaks from this church. And I run up in front, and they're waiting for their speaker. I'm like, I think I was 2 hours late. And my friend Peter, the African-American man who organized this thing, was telling jokes, or I don't know what he was doing, lighting his hair on fire, waiting for his speaker. And then I finally came, and I went up in front, and I turned around and looked at these people. I was the only white person there. All these wonderful, almost ethereally beautiful black people. I immediately could see them. Fluorescent lights, I could see them. Completely different than the CEO I was with in the morning. And they were so warm and welcoming. They cheered when I came and they clapped. And I started my conversation about the work of ending hunger in Africa because I felt that would be relevant to them. And it was a very moving encounter. I mean, they were so warm, so welcoming. And then it was time to ask for money. And here I am in Harlem and I'm thinking, should I ask for money here? Do they have money? But I realized, no, this is a fundraiser. I'm supposed to ask for money. So I do my ask. And then there's this pause, and the drip, drip, drip of the rain outside and the buckets that were catching the leaks. And then this woman stood up, and she was, I'll never forget her, name was Gertrude. And she had gray hair. She was quite slender. She had on a old-fashioned maid's uniform and a raincoat on top of it and a purse on her arm. And she stood up. She was very dignified in her stature. Older, maybe 70-year-old African-American woman. And she stood up and she said, my name is Gertrude, and I want you to know something. I like you, she said. And I said, oh, great, thank you. And she said, I want you to know something. Money is just like water. And she referred to the rain and the dripping into the buckets. it doesn't belong to any of us. It belongs to all of us or none of us. And all it does is move around this planet. And I want you to know something. It's a currency. It's a current. It carries our love, or it carries our hate and greed. It can carry whatever we say. And I have $50 in my purse. I don't have a checking account. I don't have a credit card. But I have money. I earn money from doing people's wash. And I want you to know that this $50, I realize, is for you and the work of Ending World Hunger. And I want you to know it's a current that comes through my life that I'm going to give you that's going to be carrying my love, my commitment, and my care for my brothers and sisters in Africa. And she walked up the aisle and gave me her $50. And by the time she was done with her little speech, I was kind of teary. She was kind of teary. And she hugged me and gave me $50, you know, ones and fives and some change. And I put it, I didn't have a basket or anything. So I put it, I opened my briefcase and I put it on top of the yellow $50,000 check from the food executive. And then everybody in the church lined up behind her and they gave me money, like money, $5, $17 and 22 cents, you know, $100 here, $25 there. And I just kept putting the money in my briefcase, and I would hug the people, and then they all sat down. They would go back and sit down. It was like coming to give communion, almost, to receive communion. And then they all started to sing. And it was so glorious and so warm and so fulfilling. And then I, you know, it was over, and I packed up my briefcase and my stuff and went to my little hotel, and I put the $50,000 check on the bed in my hotel. Then I put the money that I'd gotten in the church, and it was $373.37 in a pile. And I looked at the cash, and I looked at the $50,000 check, and I knew that that money, the $363.73, had more love and commitment and power in it and would do more work for the End of World Hunger than the $50,000 check from the food executive. I mean, I just had this moment, like this, God said that to me. And so I put the yellow check in an envelope and I wrote a long letter to the CEO. And I told him, I said, you know, we're an organization about commitment. And I really couldn't experience the commitment to the from the company for this contribution. And I just want to let you know that I'm sending it back. And when your company is really interested and engaged in Ending World Hunger, we would love to have a contribution. But I think this money came from a different place, so I'm going to return it. And, you know, I didn't call anybody at my office. We needed the $50,000. But I don't know, God told me to send it back. So then, you know, you think that would be the end of the story, but it's not. Because, P.S., 2 years later, I'm in my office in San Francisco. I get a handwritten letter from the CEO. And he says, I didn't remember our meeting, but I never forgot the return of that check and the letter that came with it. And it stunned me. And shortly after that, I retired and I got a very nice retirement golden parachute. And I started following the work of your organization. And I want to know if you would now accept a contribution that comes from my own pocket, that comes with my commitment, my respect for the work that you all are doing, and my heart and love to make sure that your work is forwarded and empowered by my personal check for $250,000. I hope you will accept this contribution. And I did. And that was the day that I learned about that money carries the commitment, the intention of those who give it. And I must say, I don't think you should return money. You can launder it. You can forgive it for its past. But that was a day that God told me about what money really means. So that's my story.
Now, Bill's been with you in this journey, and you write about when his partners and he created a company foundation. You know, we all experience the joy and power of contributing, investing money in the things we cared most deeply about, programs that spoke to our highest commitments, adding this change of heart brought about a change in our relationship with money. Once we began to align our money decisions with these deeper core values and our highest commitments, we experienced a dramatic shift, not only in what we did with our money, but also in how we felt about money, about our life, and about ourselves. Then you added this wonderful sentence. Eventually, we came to know ourselves not for what we had or owned, but for what we gave. Not for what we accumulated, but for what we allocated. Can you just share a little bit about, because that's like a conversion experience, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I sense that's what you try to help facilitate, almost like a midwife, with everyone you encounter.
Yeah. Well, yeah, let me see how to answer that. I'll just say my work with some of the wealthiest families in the world is to hospice the natural death of a way of being that in some cases led them to that kind of wealth that was all about accumulating, which sometimes, Gandhi said, there's enough for our need, but not for our greed on this planet. And when we start getting greedy, we lose track of who we are. And I hospice that kind of behavior, I'll say habit, and midwife the way of being of realizing that these resources aren't meant for me. Yes, I can use them to take care of my family and make sure that we're okay, but then they need to move on. And so I ask people, wouldn't you rather be known for what you allocate than what you accumulate? Wouldn't that be a way to live? A legacy is not what you leave. A legacy is how you live. That's really what the legacy is. And in many cases, it's never quite occurred to them quite that way. So, when we started realizing we'll be known for what we allocate, not what we accumulate, our life started to be much more really prosperous. We started to, what I call, we had real prosperity, aliveness, an experience of making a difference with our lives.
I wonder if we could just ask a simple story if you could close with. You tell the old folk tale called Herschel and the Hanukkah Goblins by Eric Kimmel. I just think it kind of encapsulates so much of what you help people understand.
Well, it's a famous children's book that most Jewish people know, but it's about a greedy person who wanted some pickles and put his hand in a pickle jar. It's about a lot more than that, but this is kind of the image that is short enough to end with. Put his hand in the pickle jar and put his hand around the pickles and couldn't get them out. Couldn't get his hand out of the jar and couldn't get the pickles out. And he was stuck with this jar of pickles on his hand. And was going to be, destined to wear that for the rest of his life until he realized, I need to let go. And then he could release his hand. And that's the kind of a parable about our relationship with money, that we have a grip on it so tight that we think it's who we are. And one of the great things I've learned from Brother David Stendelrast is that the open hand is the hand that gives, and the open hand is also the hand that receives. And it's when those fingers, if you can imagine your hand open, when your fingers start to curl and grasp, is the beginning of the formation of a fist. And that's the beginning of the source of all violence. And when we open our hand, we can both give and receive in equal measure. And that's the life we all want to live, and that's the life of true prosperity. True wealth, which is a life of well-being and a life worth living.
Lynn, thank you so much. Author of The Soul of Money, Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Life. This is an incredible book, and this has been an incredible podcast. We want to thank you for your time and for what you've contributed to countless people with your life. God bless you.
God bless you, and thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation.